Welcome to Leonard Lopate Weekend, where we bring you three of our favorite segments from the last week in case you missed them. You can find all of our segments on the WNYC app, our website at WNYC.org, or on iTunes. Just search for Leonard Lopate. And of course, you can also listen to us live on the radio every weekday starting at noon.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Just yesterday, President Trump rescinded protections for transgender students that had allowed them to use bathrooms corresponding with their gender identity. The decision pitted Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who has vigorously opposed any expansion of gay, lesbian, and transgender rights, against Education Secretary Betsy DeVos, who expressed her concerns about potential harm to transgender students. The rollback of LGBTQ rights is not confined to the United States, as journalist Masha Gessen reports in an article called Family Values, Mapping the Spread of Anti-Gay Ideology. It's in the March issue of Harper's Magazine, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Masha Gessen back to our show. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You lived in Russia until your mid-teens in 1981 and then returned on assignment some years later, but then you fled again in 2013. What happened?
What happened was that the government threatened to take away our kids because they were being raised by lesbians. So we decided not to take any chances with that and got out in a hurry.
But wasn't there a time when Vladimir Putin didn't seem to be much concerned about homosexual matters? You say that he wasn't concerned about people's private lives until 2012 when he started talking about traditional values. What happened?
Well, what happened was that he had come back into office for his third term as president, faced for the first time with popular resistance all over the country. There were mass protests, and he launched a political crackdown. For political crackdown, you need a few things. One of them is you need an other. And so the other of choice were the queers. He queer-baited the protesters, he also used the anti-gay campaign as part of this, and this should now sound familiar to American listeners, as part of this trope, you know, of the imaginary past. It communicated to people very effectively that Putin was promising to take them back to a time they don't quite remember, but when they are certain they felt more comfortable than now.
At first, when Vladimir Putin began passing the so-called homosexual propaganda laws, you say they seemed ridiculous, so you didn't pay attention. When did they begin to demand your attention?
Well, they first passed in a number of small towns around the country, first in small towns and sort of medium-sized towns, and then they got to St. Petersburg, and I think that's probably when I started paying attention. And also because, you know, it seemed that the term homosexual propaganda seemed so quaint to me. It sounded like something out of the 1970s, some sort of Anita Bryant throwback. So I wasn't taking it seriously until someone pointed out to me that because it was framed as the defense of children, I could be seeing my own children being defended from me. And sure enough, that's exactly what ended up happening.
Do these attitudes reflect anti-gay thinking that you're likely to find throughout Russia and Eastern Europe?
I think it works the other way around. And I'm not trying to say that people in Russia or elsewhere in Eastern Europe aren't homophobic. People, you can find homophobic people everywhere. And certainly the fewer openly gay people there are, the more people will be likely to express homophobic attitudes. But most Russians, I think, didn't think about LGBT people until the Kremlin began pushing its anti-gay agenda. And it's like with any process of othering. You know, how concerned were Americans with Muslims in the 1990s? Not terribly. You know, Some of them may have harbored anti-Muslim sentiments, and most of them just never gave it any thought until it suddenly became a sort of public priority number one, which is what happened in Russia with LGBT people.
You live in New York City now, and you say that there are many Russian gay refugees here. Did they apply for asylum because they felt threatened by Putin's government?
That's exactly what happened. I mean, you know, nobody leaves their home because they feel like it and they think it will be fun. People leave everything they know to look for a new life elsewhere because they feel desperate, because they feel like staying home is more dangerous than going to a place where they know no one and, you know, initially at least can't even work legally. So there are hundreds of LGBT asylum seekers in New York City alone. I'm talking about people from Russia. And there are many, many more people all over the country.
What are the risks in Russia for openly gay men and women? Is there still a functioning LGBTQ movement in the country?
Well, there was never much of a movement to begin with. And I don't mean to discount the efforts of the activists who do exist. But Russia was sort of in the community building stages of an LGBT movement before the anti-gay campaign began. It didn't have a strong political movement. And all of a sudden, these people who were really concerned with, you know, organizing socials and film festivals had to become political actors because they were made into political actors. And they've done a terrific job, but for most people, the consequence of the anti-gay campaign, it's not the enforcement of the ban on homosexual propaganda, which is a classic, you know, law that says nothing specific, so it can be enforced randomly, and can be used just as a tool of oppression. The biggest consequence is violence. There's street violence. There's organized violence on LGBT spaces.
Haven't there been reports for
TV violence? Yeah.
Haven't there been reports of gay men being lured into what they think are dates only to be beaten by homophobic gangs?
Yeah, I wrote an article about that for the New York Times about a year ago, after yet another murder of that type. And what I realized was happening was that I was starting to recognize obituaries. Like if you read an obituary of a man who was found stabbed to death in his own apartment and there was no sign of forced entry, it would always turn out to be that kind of story. Because it is increasingly dangerous for gay men to meet out in public, the people meet online predominantly, and also because many spaces have been destroyed, people meet online and they invite people to their houses to avoid being out in public. But that's a perfect setup for anybody who wants to engage in anti-gay violence, which is so strongly encouraged from the top.
Do they wind up going to jail if they have beaten or killed a gay man?
Sometimes, and on at least two occasions, people who have been arrested for these kinds of murders have said that they did it out of principle, that they intended to commit an anti-gay murder. At least in one case, the testimony actually contained the words patriotic and patriotic duty, and the person was unpatriotic for being queer.
My guest is Masha Gessen, who writes primarily in English these days, although she's been called Russia's leading LGBT rights activist. Her articles have appeared everywhere, and she's written a number of books. Also serves as the Russian translator of the TV show The Americans. Most recent book to be published in the fall will be The Future is History. How many of your books have been published in Russian?
One. Out of my 10 books, one has been published in Russian, and it's a book about a mathematician. Most others have in some way or another been sort of too politically problematic.
Because books with titles like The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin, or Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot, are considered a little too dangerous for publishers to touch?
Yes, exactly.
But would they be officially banned in Russia, or is it just that publishers are unwilling to take the risk?
It's publishers are unwilling to take the risk, and that's a very interesting way in which censorship works in Russia now. It's basically profit-based. Publishers, the state doesn't tell publishers what they can't publish, But there are a number of laws that are randomly enforced against bookstores and publishers. Laws on extremism, which is, you know, whenever you hear the word extremism, you know that that's an attack on freedom of speech. And homosexual propaganda, and other laws that regulate the dissemination of information to minors. So because all of these regulations are really vague, publishers tend to be extra careful. Bookstores tend to be even more careful because they're also afraid of vigilante groups that take it upon themselves to enforce laws, even if the police are not doing it. So basically, if a publisher sees a book that they think bookstores are not going to accept for distribution, then they will not publish a book, and they think that this is an economic decision.
For your article in Harper's, you traveled to Tbilisi, the capital of Georgia. Had you been there before?
I've been there a few times. It's a lovely city.
And you write that it has endured the end of the Soviet Union, a civil war, a revolution. Is it does it bear the marks of that?
It absolutely bears the marks of that. I mean, it's a beautiful city, sort of wedged between the mountains. It's very, very old. It's also dilapidated. It's sort of full of temporary structures that probably were meant to be temporary 50 years ago, and have become permanent. You can tell that the country is quite poor and has been through a lot of trauma. And the reason I traveled there was because the World Congress of Families, which is a fascinating organization, was holding its semi-regular Congress there in Tbilisi.
Its 10th Congress in the Tbilisi Congress. Concert Hall. This is a pretty big concert hall.
The opening ceremony had 2,200 people there. The hall was filled.
How many countries are represented?
I can't give you an exact count, but there are basically two sort of groups of countries. This now feels like ancient history. The Congress was less than a year ago, but it was at a different time in history when the Western Europeans and the Americans seemed embattled and felt embattled, and we're talking about all those horrible advances in transgender rights and in marriage equality, and how were they going to fight back against this onslaught of attacks on the family? And the Eastern Europeans are the proud ones, the ones who brag of all the advances that they have made in their battle against what they call gender ideology. Since then, things have changed. I think that Americans are going to have a lot to brag about at the next Congress.
But although you do hear some similar things from this Congress, from what we hear from conservative groups in the United States, the essential narrative is that the family, the natural family, is one that consists of one man and one woman and their biological children, which is the foundation of human civilization.
Right. And so the basic narrative is that that I heard at the Congress, and it was repeated by various speakers and during various workshops, that's sort of the unifying story of this organization, is that there is a culture of death and a culture of life. The culture of death is represented by proponents of what they call gender ideology, by LGBT activists. And the culture of life, is represented by the defenders of the so-called natural family, the opponents of abortion and contraception of all kinds, and opponents, of course, of LGBT rights. They are warning of an apocalyptic scenario in which humankind will die out. If you look at the graphs, if you sort of tune out the words and look at the statistic that they're showing, what they're really warning about is that they're afraid that the white race will die out. But they're a little bit too polite to say that out loud.
Although you do say that race and the language in general would be kind of shocking here. White race. They don't call. They don't use phrases like LGBT. They say pervert.
Well, it actually depends on who's talking. The Western Europeans and the Americans and the Australians are rather embarrassed by their Eastern European comrades, who will use words like pervert speaking on the stage. the Western Europeans like to say LGBT, and then call on a full-on attack on LGBT rights, but at least they don't like to use the word pervert.
They talk about gender ideology. How do they define that?
Well, there isn't a single definition, but gender ideology is a term that I've come across a lot, both in this country and in Eastern Europe and in Australia. In Australia, I've seen leaflets distributed by the opponents of the Safe Schools movement in Australia. And these leaflets warn of the impending sort of domination of gender ideology. Gender ideology is a vague term that I think encompasses the idea that gender is sexually constructed, and that there is such a thing as transgender rights, that there is such a thing as LGBT rights. But the phrase itself conjures the specter of a totalitarian ideology that is forcing itself onto these poor, unsuspecting people in these countries. And I think it taps into something very deep in Eastern Europe, especially in countries that used to be part of the Soviet Empire, that have a lived experience of having lived with a totalitarian ideology that was imposed on them by a foreign power. And so it's very easy to frame this idea that the Western world is pushing its ideology down their throats in the same terms.
I'm speaking with Masha Gessen, who's article, Family Values, Mapping the Spread of Anti-Gay Ideology, is in the March issue of Harper's Magazine. And we have a link to it on our show page at wnyc.org/Lopate. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Masha Gessen, who's written an article for Harper's in the March issue of Harper's called Family Values, Mapping the Spread of Anti-Gay Ideology. And as I mentioned, much of this involves your traveling to Tbilisi, where you attended the 10th World Congress of Families, the WCF meeting. Where does this group get its funding from?
It's not a huge group, and I didn't actually investigate its funding that much. I think it's all pretty much out in the open. I was much more interested in its history, because I think there's this idea that emerged a few years ago when the anti-gay campaign started in Russia. There was this idea that Americans are exporting hate to Eastern Europe and especially to Russia because the Christian right in the States had lost traction and had to take its wares elsewhere. And that's sort of the story that I thought I was going to find once I started writing about the World Congress of Families. It's much more complicated, much more interesting. The World Congress of Families actually had its start in a sort of convergence of the minds of an American, extremely conservative American historian called Alan Carlson and a couple of Russian sociologists in the early 1990s. And they were basing their sort of meeting of the minds on the work of Peterim Sorokin, who was a Russian exile. He was exiled by Lenin, and he founded the sociology department at Harvard. He is considered the founder of modern sociology in this country. But one of his ideas was that the Western civilization was in decline and was sort of going to descend into decadence. And it tapped very well into the sense of demographic panic in Eastern Europe after the breakup of the Eastern Bloc, when all these tiny nations became nation states again, and I think realized that they were small. And a lot of them were also experiencing depopulation, Russia especially. So there was this great fear of the unknown, this great fear of dwindling numbers, combined with a nostalgia for an imaginary past, and an intellectual footing to be found in the work of Sorokin and his contemporary follower Alan Carlson, all this led to the formation of the World Congress of Families, which is actually not an American organization as much as it was an Eastern European organization originally. And the Americans have been sort of they've given the intellectual wares, while the Eastern Europeans have given the bodies and the money. A lot of the money seems to come from Russia. And a lot of the political muscle seems to come from Russia. I think that's about to change. You know, there's certainly a lot more political muscle in the States now than there was when I was reporting this story less than a year ago.
You've been targeted by right-wing family values advocates as a representative of the enemy, someone who has personally set out to destroy the natural family. So why did Larry Jacobs, the managing director of WCF, decide to defy many members and agree to let you attend? Although, as you write, you had there were all sorts of terms of it was all had to be negotiated.
Well, it's not unusual to have to negotiate full access to a gathering, especially to a closed gathering, and everyone there knew that I probably wasn't going to write a flattering story about it. But I was surprised that Larry Jacobs was interested. I think that part of what got me in was I was reporting for a mainstream American magazine, which, again, you know, I keep saying that it's like having time traveled, because to imagine that they felt so embattled in May of last year during this Congress that interest from a mainstream American magazine was, I think, flattering and was just more exposure than this kind of politics was getting and certainly this organization was getting. So Larry Jacobs wanted a guarantee from me that I wasn't going to just do a hostile sort of hack job. And I told him nobody is interested in a piece that talks about how horrible the World Congress is for 5,000 words. That's not going to be a whole lot of fun to read. I really did want to try to figure out what made this organization and these activists tick.
Were you the only openly queer Jewish anti-Putin critic of one man, one woman marriage as an institution attendee?
I think I may have been the only one in any single category that you have just listed off.
And you report that everybody assumed Donald Trump wasn't going to win presidency, so they saw the situation as being dangerous in the United States as well.
Well, of course, this was May of last year. So really, sort of the rhetoric of it was: we are an embattled people. We, the defenders of the natural family, are embattled. The progress of LGBT rights and transgender rights is inexorable. That was sort of the leitmotif, and a lot of why that activism was sort of focused internationally was because I think they didn't have a whole lot of hope for fighting against marriage equality and fighting against transgender rights in the United States. It's a really good reminder of the fact that progress is never inexorable. To be recording this interview on the day that the day after the safety provisions for transgender students in schools are rescinded by the Trump administration is symbolic.
I'm speaking with Masha Gessen. Her article, Family Values, Mapping the Spread of Anti-Gay Ideology, is in the March issue of Harper's Magazine. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. After the first day of Congress, you attended a lavish dinner. The Russians in attendance refused to speak to you, but you ended up dining with a man you have just talked about, Alan Carlson. He was happy to talk with you?
I don't know if he was happy to talk with me, but he was genial, and we actually had a lovely conversation. He is, I think we were both sort of acting in good faith. He was in good faith trying to get his views across to me, and a lot of what he said is compelling. And, you know, I think it's important sort of not ridicule this. It's very easy to ridicule ideas like gender ideology or culture of death and culture of life. But I think, for someone like Alan Carlson, who's a very intelligent and thoughtful man, this comes from years of sort of working and thinking. He has come to the considered conclusion that the natural family is the So the bulwark of civilization. And his and my disagreement is really on the definition of family, right? I think that the idea that that small groups of people, that the private world needs to be protected against a hostile state is an idea that is that both of us find compelling. It's just that I think that a family can be constituted in any way imaginable, you know, including by one person. One person also has a right to defend their private world against a hostile state, whereas he thinks that the family can only be composed of one man, one woman, and their biological children.
Do they see themselves as kind of losing the war in Western Europe because so many of the Western European countries are now recognizing same-sex marriage and abortion rights are being granted in more of those countries? All sorts of other things that the WCF is opposed to seem to be the wave of the future, although the battles do continue in each of those, in all of those countries.
So the basic tenor of the conversation in May of last year was countries like Poland saying, don't lose hope. We are succeeding in fighting back against abortion rights and in eliminating gender and sex education in schools and reintroducing religious education in schools. And Western European countries sort of crying on their shoulder and complaining about all the new laws being adopted. I mean, Italy had just become the 27th country in Europe to recognize same-sex unions, not even same-sex marriage. I mean, it was a very limited piece of legislation in Italy. But to that crowd, it was a huge loss in a Catholic country. I think things have changed. I mean, we have the Trump administration in the United States. There are a lot of right-wing parties that are starting to become politically dominant forces in their countries. And their extremely conservative agenda and this idea of this imaginary past that really lends itself to attacks on LGBT rights and transgender rights, those kinds of parties have gained so much traction just in the 9 months that have passed.
Does the WCF have much of a presence in the United States? Hasn't the Southern Poverty Law Center classified them as a hate group?
The Southern Poverty Law Center considers them a hate group. They, until recently, haven't had much of a presence. There's another organization called the National Organization on Marriage, which has fought more political battles in the United States. It was formed to fight Proposition 8 or to defend Proposition 8 in California to fight against same-sex marriage in California. They lost, but that's how they sort of got their political legs. And the head of that organization, Brian Brown, has now become president of the World Congress of Families. And my most memorable interview at that Congress was with Brian Brown.
You write about the best speech at the conference, which came from an Eastern European, Vasadze. Who is he, and what did he talk about?
So Levon Vasadze was the host in Georgia. He is a Georgian-Russian businessman and philanthropist. He has become publicly prominent in Georgia just since 2013. What happened in 2013 there was that there was an attack on an LGBT rally. It was Idaho, the International Day Against Homophobia, which is a pretty low-key sort of celebration. It's not like a pride parade. And people were showing up in Tbilisi for Idaho on May 17th, 2013, and they got attacked by at least 1,000 bat and stone wielding thugs. People were chased through the streets. It was basically a pogrom that lasted all day. And at the end of the day, the patriarch of the Georgian church celebrated mass at the main cathedral in the city and proclaimed a victory for the church and the family in Georgia after those pogroms. And following that, the patriarch declared May 17th in Georgia the family and defense of family or something like that day. Vasadze is instrumental in that movement, the movement of some people think that he was instrumental in bussing in the thugs who beat people up, but he's certainly been the most visible face of the anti-gay movement in Georgia, and he was the architect of bringing the WCF to Georgia. And he's gorgeous. He's an amazing speaker. He speaks excellent English. He was educated at Emory University on a full scholarship because it's also in Georgia. And that pun never fails to work. Mm-hmm.
Yes, it definitely works. It confuses a lot of people, too.
Right. So he gave this incredible speech that really, in some ways I found truly compelling, because the story that he tells is this is a story of a struggle for self-determination of this tiny nation that has faced so many wars and so much so many attacks, and especially from Russia. I mean, its last war with Russia was less than 10 years ago in 2008. And it turned westward, hoping to find freedom there. But he says instead the West is pushing its own agenda and its own ideology down Georgians' throats. And the ancient civilization doesn't feel like it can get any respect from either Russia or the West.
He says some of his biggest fears come from the growth of agencies like Child Protective Services in Georgia. I would think that left and right, people would be concerned about the protection of children.
Child protection services are a huge boogeyman in all over Eastern Europe. I think there is a reason for that. I think the reason is that the idea that the state can be trusted to make decisions about families is highly suspect in Eastern Europe. I think this is exactly what sort of Alan Carlson taps into when he talks about the family against the hostile state. The experience of Eastern Europeans who lived under Soviet occupation or in the Soviet Union, in their own country, is the experience of barely being able to carve out any sort of breathing and loving and child-raising space away from the state. So it is a genuinely threatening idea. And most of these states have certainly failed to establish any kind of trust that would be necessary to make the idea of state-run child protection services credible.
Masha Gessen, her book is coming out this fall. I'm looking forward to speaking to you about it, The Future is History from Riverhead. But we've been talking about her article in the March issue of Harper's Magazine, Family Values, Mapping the Spread of Anti-Gay Ideology. You can find a link to it on our show page at wnyc.org/lopate. Masha, as always, thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Minjin Lee has won several awards for her essays and short fiction, and her first novel, Free Food for Millionaires, was a national bestseller. She's followed that now with a new novel called Pachinko that explores the long history of discrimination against Koreans living in Japan in the 20th century and follows the story of a family spanning five generations and its struggle with finding a homeland. It's published by Grand Central Publishing, and I'm very pleased it has brought Minjin Lee to our show today. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
You begin your novel with Japan's annexation of Korea in 1910. How did life change for Koreans after that event?
You know, after 1910, the Koreans in Japan, the Koreans in Korea essentially became colonial members of Japan.
Did it matter whether they were living in what became North or South Korea?
Well, North and South Korea didn't really occur until...
I understand.
Right.
But as I understand it, the Japanese put a lot more industry in the North, which actually affected relations between the two countries once there was the separation after World War II.
That's correct. And as a matter of fact, a lot of revisionist historians often look at that event of the annexation as a positive thing for Korea because it added industry and electricity and railroads, especially in the northern areas.
Who are the Zainichi?
The Zainichi are, it's kind of a misnomer for a term of people who are the Korean Japanese. Zainichi actually means foreign residents staying in Japan. The problem with that term that some historians take umbrage with is the fact that many Korean Japanese have been there for four generations or more.
They moved during the time that Korea was a colony of
exactly.
Japan. Exactly. And some then established themselves as Japanese. Think of themselves as Japanese?
I think they do think of themselves as Japanese, but they're not allowed to think of themselves as Japanese. And that's the real conundrum.
Who's Sunja? Why did she move from Korea to Japan?
So Sunja is ahistorical in the way most historians represent the Korean-Japanese story, because she actually goes there because she falls in love with an older man who's married. She becomes pregnant, and then he can't marry her, obviously. So she decides to marry somebody else who's kind to her, who's a missionary. And then she goes to Osaka, and she becomes fully Korean-Japanese without having had the intention to do so.
You've named this novel after a game, Pachinko. Why choose that for the title of the book?
Oh, well, pachinko is a $190 billion industry in Japan, so it's twice the export revenues of Japan. The reason why I named it pachinko is because it's such an important industry in Japan, and it's dominated and owned mostly by the Korean-Japanese community, who ended up flocking towards this industry because the Korean-Japanese couldn't find legal employment elsewhere or become middle-class people. So then they entered into this sort of industry that was considered a very organized crime-heavy industry.
It's like a pinball machine.
Exactly. It's a game. It's a gambling industry, but it's for adults.
And you, as somebody who lives here, you had to research this? Is all of the material readily available?
No. As a matter of fact, I lived in Japan from 2007 to 2011. And in those years, I met a lot of Korean-Japanese, and I interviewed dozens upon dozens of Korean-Japanese people.
When you're doing your research, what was the most surprising thing you learned about the Korean diaspora?
I think one of the most surprising things was feeling that they are so different from the Korean-Americans. And I'm a Korean-American. I came here when I was 7 and a half, and I grew up in Queens, New York. I feel very much like a New Yorker and an American. I feel very normal.
But Queens, if you grow up in the Korean area of Queens, you could probably live your whole life speaking Korean.
Yeah,
and
I think I
never
could.
Speak English and get along perfectly well.
I have relatives who basically don't speak that much English. So you're completely correct, because you don't have to. You can actually just go to Korean churches, Korean businesses, and sort of stay there. You work for American people, not necessarily Koreans, but then you could end up not learning English.
But there are, in some ways, Korean language, for example, has more similarities to Western languages in that it relies on an alphabet.
That's correct.
Whereas the Japanese are using Chinese characters to apply to a language that seems to have little in common with the written language.
You know, it's really interesting because Korean is easiest to learn of the East Asian languages because it has an alphabet directly.
What, 30 characters or something
I think it's 28 or 26. I'm blanking right now. Never been on the Leonard Lopate show before. But what's interesting is that they do, on higher level academic texts, they do use Hanmun, which is a part Chinese characters. So you do have to know a certain amount of Chinese characters.
Your novel deals with struggles of identity. I'm sure the audience has already kind of figuring that out. How does Sunja's children, Noah and Mosasu, is it, differ in their relationships to their with their Korean identities?
Well, because they're born in Japan, they are culturally Japanese. However, they're also culturally Korean-Japanese because the Korean-Japanese are pretty much segregated at that period in history. They were forced to live in ghettos. They're almost like shanty towns, and they weren't allowed to have regular middle-class jobs like becoming postal workers or nurses or teachers.
And were they always faced with the possibility of deportation?
Yes, until about 1993, that's when the fingerprinting laws changed. And then there are also...
1993,
the fingerprinting.
That recently?
Yes. Yes. Until then, they had to be fingerprinted. And that was considered a great insult because in Japan, to be fingerprinted at that time for about 40-plus years was only for criminals.
Mosasu's son, Solomon, has to deal with the threat of deportation to Korea when he's just 14 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Does he feel connected to his Korean roots?
Oh, not at all. Because most people who are actually born in Japan, who are of ethnic Korean heritage, when they do go back to Korea, they're not considered Korean. They're considered Japanese. And they're kind of considered almost like betrayers.
Even though, in many cases, they had no choice. They just...
They're completely accidents
of
history.
Were brought to Japan.
Yes.
There are also some pretty famous Japanese people who grew up in Korea.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Toshio Mifune, the great Japanese film star, spent much of his youth in Korea.
That makes sense, yeah.
What was so Solomon winds up with the British Investment Bank? Are foreign companies a way to get around the discrimination against Koreans?
I think that there's a kind of misplaced idea that, I mean, it's really tragic because when Solomon is Moses's son, and Moses is Sunja's son, so this is the fourth generation in, and he believes that because his father has money and is educated at Columbia University, when he goes back to Japan, he thinks that by working at a British investment bank, he'll be treated well. Mm-hmm. However, of course, he isn't. And that's really sad because there's a wish that somehow the Japanese who are in charge, even at Western banks, will treat you kindly. But no one ever seems to forget that you're ethnically Korean, even today.
My guest is Min Jin Lee, whose second novel is Pachinko. And so you say you lived in Japan for how many years?
4 years.
And you felt that discrimination the whole time?
No, actually it was kind of funny because I felt it occasionally. Like I would forget because I was, you know, mostly with expatriates. I was interviewing many Korean Japanese and Japanese people. However, I feel like an American. But once in a while I would have a certain encounters with people like my Japanese landlord.
Well, Japanese expats tell me that when they go back, they are spotted right away as being American, not as Japanese, even though they may have been born in Japan by the way they walk, the way they talk. Were you spotted immediately as an outsider?
Well, first of all, I'm really tall, so I tend to stand out a bit, get wanted or unwanted attention consequently. But I think that what was interesting to me was being an expatriate, very often I would essentially walk around like an observer because I'm an Asian person in an Asian country and people can't necessarily tell, I don't think. However, I would have certain encounters where, let's say, for example, with a Japanese landlord, I would complain about a leak in a ceiling and they would say something like, oh, you're complaining because Koreans like to complain.
Oh.
I know. It was really weird because I always think of Asian Americans, this big tent that I sort of fall under, as a group that doesn't complain that much. So I thought, oh, wait, hang on. I'm really surprised. So that was kind of like that kind of thing would happen now and then. I would be reminded that I have Korean blood because blood is a very important thing in Japan.
And so is religion, obviously.
Mm. Yeah, religion.
Koreans, are there a lot of Christians in Korea? Not too
a
many
lot
in
of
Japan.
Christians. Well, in Japan, Christianity is seen as a cult. So very educated people will think that you are in a cult if you're a Christian.
Well, if you're a member of Sun Myung-moon's Christian group, you are a member of a cult.
That is a cult, absolutely. But
but
he's not
but
really
all Christians
yeah.
are seen as members of a cult?
I'm Presbyterian, which is probably the most boring Protestant sect. And I was actually asked by a very educated person, well, isn't Presbyterianism a cult? And I thought, really? That's new.
Well, religion plays an important role in Korean politics as well.
Mm-hmm,
doesn't
mm-hmm.
the current political crisis involve the daughter of a spiritual leader?
Right. And she is a member of a cult. And there's a shamanistic element involved in that one. And that was really troubling for most people in Korea.
How does Sunja's husband, Isaac Baek, struggle with religion and politics?
Well, I think that he really didn't want to get involved in the politics. He was very involved in the religious aspect of it. But one of the things that should be known about Korean history is that the principal architects of the resistance against the Japanese colonialism era were Presbyterian ministers who came out of Pyongyang, which is the principal seminary of Korea.
We go through a bunch of different generations, so things change.
Sure.
There's tension between familial and romantic love
mm-hmm.
throughout this book. You also have included a number of explicit sexual encounters. What role did you intend for sex to play in telling this story?
One of the things that I really found interesting about the lives of the poor, and these are very poor people for a very long time, and they are an oppressed minority. However, they found great consolation in love, whether it's family love or romantic love. And it was interesting for me to interview people when they did talk about sex and failed love. And people were quite forthcoming about their love lives in my interviews.
Now, are marriages arranged in Korea in the same way that they are in Japan?
Among
the Koreans?
Yeah, for much of the history of Japan and Korea, arranged marriages are considered to be good things. And I do understand why. because, you know, you have this idea of families having good intentions and seeing what will work with each other.
Your novel spans over 70 years. Would you say that the struggles that these people face change from generation to generation?
I do think that they change, but I think what's really upsetting to me still is just how Koreans, no matter how many generations there are considered to be outsiders.
And that's even today?
That's absolutely even today.
Exile is another recurring theme in the novel. But these are people who are experiencing exile sometimes on a, much more of a mental level than on a physical level.
Huh, I like that a lot. Yeah, I do think so. And what's weird about this exile is that they actually don't have a home anymore because the Korea in their minds doesn't even exist anymore.
Before you became a full-time writer, weren't you a lawyer?
I was a lawyer.
Do you think that your experience in law has informed your writing?
I do. I think so because I think lawyers are trained to think more logically or to focus on the issues and to be less emotional about the facts. And I think sometimes I was able to be a bit more distant with what happens, especially the things that weren't fair. In my interviews, I'm able to be a lot more objective, I think, because I was once a lawyer.
First sentences are always important to a novel. Yours is, history had failed us, but no matter.
I think that line for me was the thesis of the entire book. I feel like history has failed most of us, regular people. And yet, because a story is incomplete and because things are unfair, most of history is decided without us being at the table. But what I really notice in all of my interviews is that regular people persist anyway. And they care about the things that regular people care about, like families and feeding their families and putting a roof over their heads.
You talk about your interviews. Were you interviewing in preparation for this novel, which, as I understand, is actually going to be expanded into a trilogy? Or mm-hmm. were you doing journalism as well?
I was doing some journalism for Condé Nast publications and other kinds of publications like Wall Street Journal, New York Times. But then I also was primarily thinking about this book, Pachinko, for my interviews. And I did very long, exhaustive interviews because I think that I kind of want to be a journalist, but of course I can't do it. It's just too difficult.
But journalists admire you because your debut novel, Free Food for Millionaires, was one of the top 10 novels of the year for the Times of London, but also NPR's Fresh Air, Terry Gross, mm-hmm. USA Today. Short fiction has been featured on NPR's Selected Shorts, and you've written travel mm-hmm. pieces as well for Condé Nast Traveler.
Mm-hmm. I have.
And now a second novel, one of three.
Yes.
How far are you into the other two?
Oh, so Free Food for Millionaires, my first book, was about the Koreans in America. So Pachinko is about the Koreans in Japan.
So this is number two.
Yes. So my third one is called American Hagwon, which right now I'm kind of like doodling and sketching out, and I'm doing interviews, and that's about the role of education for Koreans around the world.
Pachinko is published by Grand Central Publishing, and my great thanks to Min Jin Lee for stopping by to talk about it.
Oh, thank you so much.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In 1984, my brother Philip tape recorded over 20 hours of conversations with our mother, Frances Lopate. She was 66 years old at the time, and their conversations about her life covered a wide range of topics. Philip stored the tapes in a shoebox in his closet, where they remained for over 30 years, until he listened to them and decided to transcribe them. They are the basis of Philip's latest book called A Mother's Tale, which is published by Ohio State University Press. Philip directs the nonfiction MFA program at Columbia University, and he is the author of many books, including The Art of the Personal Essay and To Show and to Tell, The Craft of Literary Fiction. I'm always happy to welcome my brother Philip Lopate back to our show. Hi.
Thanks for having me. I've been looking forward to this for a long time and dreading it as well.
Well, let's try to keep it as formal as possible.
Okay.
Now, how do you see this? Is this memoir? Is this biography? You're famous for your personal essays. Is this a kind of an extended form of personal essay?
It's not a memoir. It's not a classic memoir. I actually think of it as almost a play. It's like a dialogue with three people, my mother and me. I was about 41 years old at the time. She was 66. and myself now in my early 70s looking back and listening to these two people and commenting, weaving a kind of essayistic commentary around these dialogues.
Why did you decide to tape these conversations in the first place? And how did she feel about the project?
She wanted it. I had written a few essays about the family, and I think that she wanted to get the record straight. So I also think, since I was always sort of rationing my time with my mother, that this would give her a chance to spend a lot of time with me. And indeed, we spent over 20 hours together.
Getting the record straight, because in writing about her or other members of the family, this is always a problem when people write memoir. Sometimes their feathers get ruffled. Sometimes people feel underrepresented. And
exactly.
This was an opportunity for her to make sure that anything she wanted to say was on the record.
Yes, she had said to me that everything I wrote was wrong. And I said, well, how is it wrong? I'm curious. And she said, well, it isn't that it didn't happen, but why do you have to keep going back to that period, that unhappy period, meaning my childhood, you know? So, which, of course, childhood is considered the gold of a writer's retinue. And so this gave her a chance to set the record straight. And ultimately, it gave me a chance to let her have her say, because most writers who write autobiographically, they have a twinge of guilt that they've used somebody, that they've distorted their story. And in this case, she's there, you know? Mm.
It's her voice.
What?
It's definitely her distinctive voice. Only she could have said things like, the only thing I ever got out of your grandfather was aggravation and an allergy.
She had a very colorful way of speaking. And as I was transcribing the tapes, I kept being astonished and delighted by her turns of phrase, her concrete use of metaphor, her ability to fasten on the one detail that would make something a story. She was a real storyteller, and I learned tons from her in that regard.
But you didn't listen to the tapes for a long time. Did you ever consider listening to them, perhaps after she died?
No, because she died in 2000, and it still took me over 16 years to listen to them. So I think that I was just afraid, you know.
But did she ever bring it up? Did she ever wonder why you didn't use the tapes or at least transcribe them?
When we were having the conversations, she was sure that I was going to exploit them. And she was very wary about the fact that I was a writer. She accused me of being clinical, I thought that was a great compliment, actually. But I think she thought that I would use them. And even when I was a teenager and I first started writing short stories, she would say, "So you're writing about me, huh?" Hmm. And maybe I wasn't, but in a way, she was saying, "Please write about me," because she always craved attention.
So what led you to revisit the tapes after all those years?
I don't know, except that I think that my fear of being overwhelmed by my mother was loosened and my curiosity kicked in. And I just wanted to hear her voice again. And in fact, when I listened to the tapes, I felt a joy hearing her voice in the room again, you know? She was very alive. She was a very articulate speaker, as you know, with good diction. Good. That's where you got that from, the elocution, whereas I mumble. But she had a very strong delivery.
She was born in Boston,
yes.
And so I grew up with a Boston accent.
She never let us forget that Boston.
she was born in 1918, so her life spanned most of the major events of the 20th century.
Yes.
And as you look at her life, it can be broken up into three or four different segments.
As I was working with this material, I thought that in some ways she was representative or emblematic of many other women who had passed through this same historical passage. And I think in part I was trying to rationalize why was I working on a book about my mother? And I thought, well, maybe she would resonate with many other people. So in a way, she had passed through all these events, like you know, the Depression, the Holocaust, the Eisenhower years, the 60s, women's lib, gay rights, and so on.
And then she had different kinds of careers.
She had different kinds of careers.
Eventually winding up in show business.
Yes. She had worked in a factory. She ran a candy store. She worked in the garment industry. She was a clerk for a while. She had a camera store. Anything else I'm forgetting, Lenny?
That's most of the things. But, yeah, there were other little jobs that she had here and there.
She was basically downwardly mobile. She was born into a middle-class family, and then she became lower middle class partly by marrying our father and living a more bohemian existence.
And you tried to encourage her to see herself as a member of a particular social class.
Yes.
But she resisted.
She wasn't having any of that. She didn't want to see herself in the context of other women. As far as she was concerned, hers was the big story, and it was the only story.
I'm speaking to Philip Lopate about his latest book, A Mother's Tale, which is published by Mad River Books, an imprint of Ohio State University Press. Why do you think she represented herself as a German Jew when her parents, we learned after she died, came from Ukraine?
Well, her grandparents and her parents came from Riga, and Riga was one of those places that was conquered by everybody and passed back and forth. And my mother, God bless her, was a snob, and German Jews in her mind ranked higher than Russian Jews, which is what my father was.
And she was the youngest of 11 children, orphaned at a very early age.
Yes, that was a big tragedy of her life. Her father died when she was 10, and her mother died when she was 11, at which point she began to be passed around from one sibling to another. And, of course, they did not treat her with the same love and sweetness as her own parents.
And we, as members of the family, heard many of these stories over and over again.
The atrocity stories of how badly she was treated. She didn't seem to have any capacity to think of herself into what her siblings, her older siblings, were going through. You know, how difficult it might have been for them to take in this kid who was very temperamental.
And she wound up running away as a teenager at the age of 16.
Younger than that, 14, I think it was, yeah.
This is something that affected her life as well, because people just assumed she'd run away because she was pregnant, which wasn't the case.
Yes. In this regard, she had a complete right to be offended by her sisters, because they spread the false story that she ran away because she was pregnant, which wasn't true at all. But they were very uptight and bourgeois, and they didn't know how to explain to anybody why she wasn't there, where she had gone.
So then, I'm not going to go through the whole story, but she winds up meeting our father, Albert Lopate, also the child of immigrants, and she tells you that almost immediately she realized that the marriage was a big mistake.
That's correct.
And it lasted how many years?
Probably half a century. But she had very mixed feelings about our father, mostly negative. But, you know, I suspect that she cared for him more than she would let on. It wasn't her style to ever express gratitude towards him. Even when they first started going out together, she had tried to kill herself, and he saved her life. And she always sort of dismissed that as, oh, well, what was he going to do?
Now, we get her version of our father in this book. You've also written a long essay about him called The Story of My Father.
That's correct.
And I've resisted writing about our father, but I probably would come up with a third version of him.
Whenever you have a family, you have a entirely different perspectives, you know. And, you know, there were four kids in our family, and I shudder to think if the other three siblings wrote their own memoirs.
Now, she always sang.
Yes.
And she had actually performed a bit after she'd run away, but then after she got married and wound up having four kids and everything, she gave up show business for a while.
She never actually went into show business, but she was a woman who had a lot of dreams and a lot of fantasies, a lot of expectations from life that generally were thwarted. And she eventually did go into show business.
She did it through the back door. She was working at M. Lowenstein and Son, a fabric company, and they put on company shows. And she met a songwriter, director named Bob Waxman, who not only took her under his wing, but also wrote material for her.
That's right. This is such a quaint notion that a corporation would have would actually hire somebody to put on a company show, a company review. But the two of them worked together, and Bob, in fact, helped her put on a nightclub act at one point. And eventually she started doing dinner theater and going on tour and doing commercials and things like that. All of it after she was 50. And she would hand in her glossies, her headshots, and say, "Just remember, I'm not just another pretty face."
She was her breakthrough when she was hired as a replacement, playing Madame Dupinay and the boyfriend?
Well, she certainly got a lot out of that. And she not only went on tour, but she was kind of like the person who kept all the other actors in line, because they were mostly much younger and much more frivolous. And so she got a little extra salary being the kind of house mother.
And then she started doing dinner theater and traveled to Canada and throughout the country, Houston, Jackson, Mississippi. She played Golda in touring companies of Fiddler on the Roof. Yes. And then she started doing TV commercials.
Yeah. I think in some ways what I was trying to wrestle with was the fact that she had a very event-filled life. She had done a lot of different things. She had even succeeded at a lot of different things, and yet she always felt angry and frustrated. And so she had all this vitality, and she also had all this anger inside her.
Well, there were a lot of near misses. For example, her most famous commercial was from 1969, the Alka-Seltzer commercial, "Mamma Mia, That's a Spicy Meatball," which many people considered one of the greatest commercials ever made, and yet it didn't run long because of objections by the mafia don Joe Colombo, who said he was the head of the Italian-American Anti-Defamation League, and that commercial was insulting to Italians, which it wasn't, but it got pulled off the air. So it only got a run of a month or so.
But then it kept being shown again and again, and she would get residuals from it. But in general, one of the ironies is that my mother had a kind of show business career as a Italian, but I should say a faux Italian, because she wasn't Italian at all. But she also was in that poster, "You Don't Have to Be Jewish to love Levy's," pretending to be Italian. And then at a certain point, she was up for a role in The Godfather, and that's when the Italian-American League also said, "She's not Italian, you know," so she ended up being an extra in that movie.
She also was going to be in Lovers and Other Strangers, wound
yes.
up with. There were a lot of near misses. She did a Benson and Hedges commercial just around the time that cigarette ads were banned. She was signed by Barbara Streisand's agent, who just thought she was terrific, but then he didn't get her any work because getting Barbara one job was the equivalent of getting her mother 1,000 jobs. And it went on and on and on.
But that's so common for anybody in show business, you know. For every star, there are people who are going around with 100 anecdotes of near misses. I could have been a contender.
On the other hand, she also did got ambitious in later life. She went to college.
She went to college. She even took writing classes. She finally found a teacher who told her, "You're a much better writer than your son, Philip." Our family.
That was a bitter laugh, Phil.
Well, there's always been a certain amount of competitiveness in our family, as you know.
She continued to perform mostly at senior citizen centers, including the day before she died.
Yes, she was part of a troupe of old troopers who went around to senior citizens centers, and she finally decided to quit. She decided that she was getting a little too old for it, and And the day after she did her last show, she died of a massive heart attack.
Looking back at the taping of these conversations, are there things that you wish you had asked her in retrospect?
No. The fact is that doing the tapes gave me an opportunity to ask her to fill in a lot of details, the kind of things that most children never learn about their parents.
In some cases, they don't want to know. There
they
are
don't.
Things that might be called inappropriate in some of these conversations.
Yes. Well, one of the strange things about our parents is that they did not have a filter or a censor. They did not have this notion of things you can't tell children. So my mother talked quite freely about her sex life. And at one point, I actually tape recorded my father, and he said that his greatest regret in life was that he didn't strangle my mother to death. So my mother said her great regret was that my father didn't die, but she didn't want to kill him, she just wanted him to die. My father actually wanted to kill my mother. And so so merrily they went along, you know?
Is it possible to write or think about our parents as autonomous individuals and not just the impact they had on us?
I think that
lives?
It's so important, and I think I've read many, many memoirs by people about their parents. You know, to some degree, we never have done with our parents, so we think about them all the time. That's certainly true for me. But this format gave me an opportunity to not just mold my mother into my character, but to have her be her own character.
Well, you said that she was concerned that you might be using her. How do you think she would have reacted to the finished book?
I think she would have really liked it because she would like the attention.
Well, thank you so much for giving us some attention here. Philip Lopate's latest book is A Mother's Tale. It's from Mad River Books, an imprint of Ohio State University Press. You probably at work on something quite different now.
Yes, always something different, but I'm glad I got this out of my system.
Thanks again for being on our show.
And thank you.
Thanks for listening to Leonard Lopate Weekend. We'll be back live on the radio on Monday at noon, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at Leonard Lopate or at facebook.com/LeonardLopateWNYC. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.